Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, with cold weather tightening its grip on the region, the race to restore gas service to the Merrimack Valley.
Last night it was in the teens, so what one little heater was doing, it was not like enough.
Also today, now the Democrats have won back the House, why some say it's time for them to fight dirty. And why Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton says it's time to fight Nancy Pelosi again.
The American people have been very, very clear that it's time for new leadership, and we can't answer that call by reinstalling the same leadership we've had since 2006.
And More Than Words, a Boston bookstore that uses the power of books to help young people.
All these books in one place, it's just like a wonderland. I could probably come into work and just start picking out a book, reading it, put it back on a shelf.
That's all coming up next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's only November, but winter weather is upon us, with temperatures expected to drop into the teens tonight. For most of us, it's no big deal, or at worst, a minor irritant. Our homes are heated, our showers hot. But that's not the case for too many families in the Merrimack Valley. 2 months after a series of gas explosions caused hundreds of fires and left one young man dead. According to Columbia Gas, more than 4,000 customers still have no gas. The mayor of Lawrence says 1,100 families in that city are living in their homes without gas service. So a short while ago, we spoke to Carmen Vega from Lawrence. She's a program coordinator and mental health clinician who's been helping families struggling with this ongoing crisis.
It's affected us, especially with, I have my extended family and my immediate family living with me. I have an elderly mother that's 75, and then I have a small child of 9 years. So I feel the biggest thing is like trying to keep them both on a stable, consistent routine. And I have not been able to do that. You know, we've had to be going to hotels and at family or friends' homes. And yeah, it's been pretty hard.
Where are you living right now, Carmen?
So we go from hotel and at home. And like I said, friend's house as well.
Yeah. So it must be very, very difficult. When you're at home, give us a sense there. I mean, is there fear about another explosion, for example? What's that like?
So it is. It is a lot of fear. Even, for instance, right now, thinking it would be awesome to be back to what our normal was, which where when we turn on the faucet, we can have an option of cold or hot. You know, so that would be awesome to have hot water and heat in our homes. But now I'm even thinking, you know, when we do have heat and hot water, it's like, are we safe? Is there going to be another explosion? Is there going to be gas leak? One of the things even now, like, I don't sleep too well because I think, you know, that I'm smelling something, or I'm up when we do stay home, I'm up checking on the space heaters, making sure, you know, nothing happened to the space heater. And a few times last week and this week, our lights have gone off.
Mm.
Our power have gone off. So thank God, like, I was up and I was able to, you know, just a few minutes without a space heater. But if I wouldn't have been up, you know, that would have been really bad in the morning.
Yep, I understand. Carmen, so you're program coordinator for family services, and that means that you've been involved in helping others who are out of their homes and in similar situations like the one you're dealing with. Give me a sense of what you're hearing from these people that you're working with and trying to help.
Well, what I'm hearing is fear. I hear some desperation. I hear I want to be back to normal. I want my kids to be able to sleep in their beds. I want to be able to make a meal for my family. And one of the touching women that I saw there is this woman that she was like newly diagnosed with cancer. And she was just so fearful of, number one, being, you know, diagnosed that she had cancer, but now like all the, you know, the everything that we're going through as well, where she just wanted to make it somewhat normal for her children because she hadn't gone into therapy yet, any chemotherapy or anything. But she was thinking, how, you know, are we going to be able to stay home with her children? So as a mom, I just, yeah, that was one of the most difficult ones.
Carmen, did you have any sense when this crisis occurred more than 2 months ago that 2 months in, we'd still be dealing with this problem with so many homes without gas, without heat, without hot water?
No way. No way. I was thinking at best, maybe, you know, 2-3 weeks and, you know, saying at best and we'll hold off and, you know, at least it's moderate temperature. It's not freezing. So never did I think that next week is Thanksgiving and I'm not going to be able to cook dinner for my family. So yeah, so it's been, it wears on you a lot emotionally. It does, you know, wear us down. It even like boiling water and just not being into that routine and trying to still keep a normal, you know, somewhat normal life. It's been very hard.
Yeah.
It's been very hard.
I understand. In your job, you're the one who, in a sense, has to know how to handle different aspects of the crisis, how to get a space heater, how to contact Columbia Gas, where to find resources. But have you found that for the average person you work with, that it's difficult to know how to take care of all these things?
Yes, you would see the families coming in and they were just being fed so much misinformation, whether through family or whether maybe speaking to someone in Columbia Gas that gave them the wrong information. And luckily, since I'm going through it, I was able to, you know, steer them into the correct direction and correct information.
I understand. So we're reading the Associated Press is reporting that Columbia Gas says it will have some crews working on Thanksgiving. What's your reaction to that? What's your experience been like with Columbia Gas since the explosion? Because I know initially, and you just made reference to this, there was a lot of confusing information being issued. Do you feel like that Columbia Gas has gotten to a point where they're being a little more helpful, or what's your feeling about that?
They have been more helpful. I believe now it's a little more consistent. You know, sometimes we struggle where, for instance, they'll tell us, oh, yes, we'll be there on Wednesday. And, you know, Wednesday 10 o'clock and Wednesday 10 o'clock comes and yeah, there's no one there. this week, they said they were going to come, for instance, today and at 8 o'clock and they were there at 7:30. So, you know, so I think it's getting a little bit better.
So, Carmen, give me a sense. Do you have a sense of when you and your family are going to be able to actually get back into your house and it will be as it was, heated, comfortable, and able to essentially provide a comfortable place for you to live in this cold weather?
Yeah, I'm hoping before Christmas would be nice, you know, to have my Christmas tree up and having my kids open their gifts, you know, at home and not at a hotel room or, you know, or having to rent out, you know, some space. We had originally had a relit date from October 25th, and then it was moved to 11-2, 11-14, and so on. And now our new date is 11-23.
Oh, boy. Well, Carmen, what about Thanksgiving? Where are you going to be on Thanksgiving?
So, Thanksgiving, let's see, I spoke to Columbia Gas because Columbia Gas is doing meals for the people that are still affected. So I already reserved a dinner with them, and they are giving us the option either to eat at the Elks or take it home. So I'm going to play it by ear, and I don't know, maybe by some miracle, it'll be like, hey, it's New England, it could be 50 degrees. Or it could be 60 on Thanksgiving, and maybe we can have, hopefully have it at home.
All right. Well, Carmen, thanks so much for talking to us today, and we wish you all kinds of good luck, and we're sorry you're going through this, but thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
That's Carmen Vega, a program coordinator and mental health clinician for Family Services in Lawrence, talking about the two-month-long ordeal facing families in the Merrimack Valley. Stay with us. Coming up, Congressman Seth Moulton's second effort to stop Nancy Pelosi's bid to become Speaker. And is it time for Democrats to fight dirty? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's a key moment for Democrats with a new majority in the House of Representatives. The party needs to decide how it's going to govern in the final 2 years of President Trump's first term. And among the first big questions, is Nancy Pelosi the person to lead them? Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton says no, it's time for new leadership. Once again, he's trying to stop Pelosi's bid to become Speaker, and this time he says he has the votes to back him up. 17 representatives have reportedly signed a letter with Moulton pledging not to support Pelosi. Here's Congressman Moulton on CNN yesterday.
The American people have been very, very clear that it's time for new leadership, and we can't answer that call by reinstalling the same leadership we've had since 2006.
Now, Pelosi says she has the votes to win. She told reporters that, quote, I will be Speaker of the House no matter what Seth Moulton says, end quote. Boston Herald Washington Bureau Chief Kimberly Atkins joins us now from Washington. Kimberly, good to have you back on Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so you've been reporting on Salem Congressman Seth Moulton's recent push to stop Speaker Pelosi from stopping Nancy Pelosi from becoming Speaker. What are the latest developments? What are you seeing down there?
Yeah, so as of today, Leader Pelosi is standing confidently, at least publicly, saying that she will be reelected, as you said, despite what Congressman Moulton or anybody else says. She says herself she hasn't seen this letter, points out that nobody else has, and seemed fairly confident today. But meanwhile, at the same time, you have people who oppose her saying as many as 30 people may be on this letter when it is finally released sometime, maybe at the end of the week is what I'm hearing.
I see.
But, so there's a big caveat of that, a couple of things about this letter. Even if they release it, and even if it does have a couple dozen names on it, that in itself does not mean that Nancy Pelosi won't be Speaker. The election that we're talking about will take place on the House floor in January. So that gives both sides a couple of weeks to try to garner up enough support to get over the finish line. And we've already seen some folks, including people on the list, like Congressman Ed Perlmutter from Colorado. He signed this letter, but he also said in an interview, you know, maybe there are other options that might satisfy him. For example, if Pelosi is Speaker, but there's more diversity among other leadership posts.
Mm-hmm.
He's looking for change and not necessarily a change at the top. So there is a lot of room here to wiggle around. But this is a significant challenge to Nancy Pelosi, who up until now was acting as if it was all but a certainty
yeah.
that she would assume the gavel.
So, Kimberly, just a really basic question. Tell us about the numbers. So if he's got 30 people, I understand what you said. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's the way they'll vote in January. But what's the significance of 30 people? How many votes, in other words, can Nancy Pelosi lose and still become Speaker?
Sure. So depending on how the still undecided races in the midterm go, Nancy Pelosi will not be able to lose support of more than about 18 Democrats, assuming that all Republicans vote against her, which may or may not happen. But she won't be able to lose any more than 18 Democratic votes against her to get to that 218 threshold to be elected Speaker. A Speaker has to win the majority of the entire House.
Interesting.
In that vote on the floor.
Right.
So there's a vote that takes place before that among the Democratic caucus where she just needs a majority of the Democratic caucus. It's no doubt that she will get that. That happens later this month. But we're talking about that final vote in January. So that's where this 18 number, and it may not even be that much if all the Democratic candidates who are still in these toss-ups right now, if they don't all win. So that's why the 17 number is fairly significant. That alone could possibly, if they all vote no on the floor, keep her from getting to that threshold.
Right. So Seth Moulton's position represents, he's on one side of a divide in the Massachusetts delegation. I want to talk to you a little bit about that. We've heard from Congressman Jim McGovern, from Richard Neal. They stand to take over powerful committees. They support Pelosi. So right. If Moulton's argument is the party needs new leadership, what's the argument to remain loyal to Pelosi?
Well, the argument is that she is tried and tested. We are going to have a Democratic House that is going to be battling, in particular, with a White House led by Donald Trump. And Nancy Pelosi, among other things, has shown that she is no shrinking violet and that she can stand up to the types of attacks that Donald Trump can wield while at the same time working to try to get things done on issues such as health care. Of course, she was the one who ushered through the Affordable Care Act back in 2010. And also, you know, they point out that speakership isn't just an honorary title. This is a job that is really important. It's important to whip up votes. It's important to be a good negotiator. It's important to be a good fundraiser. And these are all strengths that Nancy Pelosi has shown time and again over time, and that at this time when Democrats need to score something some wins in a divided government, that she is the person to stick with.
Right. And doesn't, her supporters as well give her significant credit, or at least some credit, for how well the Democrats did in all those House races across the country, right?
Absolutely. I mean, as much as her critics claim that she was a boogeyman for Republicans, it seems that her wins in the midterms far exceeded her liabilities, political liabilities in that way. She was a master fundraiser. And in a lot of these races, she was either a benefit or the voters simply didn't care about House Speaker, frankly, and didn't serve to be as big of a boogeyman as Donald Trump and other Republicans tried to tag her. It's a tougher argument to make, particularly if Democrats win more seats and get somewhere close to 40,
yeah.
Which is, you know, they're at the biggest margin since the Nixon era,
yeah.
In terms of the shift in the House. It's really tough to argue against that kind of performance and say, well, you know, it's not working.
And by the way, they're continuing to pick up seats. I think I read just before we came on air that they picked up two more seats today. So these wins right. keep coming in.
Right. Right. It really is.
Yeah. Kimberly, what does it mean? I want to come back to Seth Moulton. He's tried this before. He's sort of established himself as a bit of a maverick. He opposed Pelosi before, called for new leadership. What does it mean for him if he comes up short again?
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's much of a downside for Congressman Moulton. He seems to be in a pretty reliable district. I think his constituents like him. I don't think he's in any risk of losing his seat in 2 years. He, as you said, came in as a maverick. You know, he came in by defeating a Democratic incumbent to win that seat in the first place.
Right.
And he was always anti-establishment. He's always been somebody who's willing to stand up to Democrats as well as Republicans. So that's kind of the reputation he staked out for himself. So I don't see a loss in this sense really harming him personally, which I think is one of the reasons why he's someone out front in this, because there are a lot of Democrats who may want to change at the top, but who are afraid of the repercussions if they go against Nancy Pelosi. I think, if anything, this just further raises his profile as he's listed among the very, very numerous people from Massachusetts alone who may be in the 2020 hunt.
Yeah, really. In the 2020 hunt for the White House.
For president.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Boston Herald Washington Bureau Chief Kimberly Atkins, she joined us from Washington. Kimberly, thanks so much. We really appreciate it. It's always good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, for more on the battle over the Speaker of the House and for a larger conversation about Democratic strategy going forward, I'm going to turn to Scott Ferson. He's a Democratic strategist and the president of the Liberty Square Group, a political strategy firm. He was senior advisor during Congressman Seth Moulton's 2014 campaign, and he has worked for both Congressman Stephen Lynch and the late Senator Edward Kennedy. Scott Ferson, good to have you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming back in to Radio Boston. Boston. And joining us from Chicago is David Ferris. He's Program Director for Political Science at Roosevelt University. And his book, which came out this year, is called It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. David, hello to you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. And listeners, we want to invite you into this conversation. We've got some time to stretch out here. We'd love to get your input into this. We want to hear from you. As the Democrats retake the House, what should their strategy be? Bipartisanship, working across the aisle, finding ways to compromise with President Trump, or steadfast opposition? And by the way, should Nancy Pelosi still be at the helm? All these questions. Call us whether or not you're a Democrat. Republicans, we want to hear from you. Independents, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Scott, let me start with you. You've worked closely with Congressman Moulton, and this is obviously not a new fight for him, but what's your take on his argument on his latest case?
Yeah, I actually think that Congressman Moulton is correct, that we need new leadership. They got, I think, 65, 67 votes last time in caucus 2 years ago. And I think his case was stronger then. I mean, it was not clear that Nancy Pelosi's leader was going to be able to get us out of the woods. And I think it's weaker now in that I think she did.
Yeah.
And you could argue with
Exactly. I mean, this argument that she had a lot to do with this enormous Democratic success last week.
Yeah, and I think the optics of, frankly, removing the female leader. The two other people in leadership who are both 78 and 79 years old and both happen to be male, I think the optics for the Democratic Party, I'm not sure we need this fight right now.
Yeah.
And I would think, just given the age of the leadership, putting Seth's efforts into bringing up that younger class of leadership, a lot of whom were elected on last Tuesday, I thought would have been better well spent.
David Ferris, we're going to get to your sort of central argument in your book, is it time to fight dirty? But I want to ask you the same question. What do you make of this fight for this leadership, and in particular, people like Seth Moulton's opposition to Nancy Pelosi? Good route for Democrats to take?
I don't think this is the time for the fight either. I mean, I could see a scenario where had Democrats lost the House, if they won the popular vote by 3, 4, or 5 points and they lost the House because they couldn't win in the suburbs, then I think that would have strengthened the case against Pelosi. But in fact, they won in the kinds of places that they really need to win moving forward. And I think that you have to give Speaker Pelosi some credit for that. And so it just seems like an odd time for a move against her. And I also think if they were going to do it, they should have had, a consensus alternative lined up. And I don't see that they do. The person that they've been floating, Marsha Fudge, she's 66, so.
She's a Democratic congresswoman from Ohio, right?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She would be fine. But I think if the argument is that the leadership has been in place for too long or they're too old, I don't think that Marsha Fudge really fits that narrative. I think the real failure here is for top Democrats not to have groomed a successor to Pelosi, because I think now would be a good time to start getting that person into place and sort of teaching that person the skills that Pelosi clearly has so that the handoff can be smooth.
Hmm.
And I think, unfortunately, we have a fight brewing, and I don't think it's going to look good for Democrats.
I want to move on from the sort of Seth Moulton angle here, but I am intrigued about this. I didn't ask Kimberly Atkins this question. Scott, I'll come to you. I'll come to both of you, but I'll start with you, Scott. I mean, I'm just curious about, Kimberly's take, which I agree with, is that this sort of burnishes, whether or not he wins this effort, it sort of burnishes Moulton's image as a maverick, and that's always good for a politician to have, especially a politician like him. But what does it do if you're the guy in Washington who has twice gunned for the speaker, fired and missed? Doesn't that kind of weaken your position within the party in a certain way, or not?
Yeah, no. I can tell you this about Seth Moulton, who I know pretty well.
Yeah,
and he doesn't care. He's not calculating. He might be calculating, but he's not calculating in that way. And and frankly, if you take a step back, that's what we said. That's what we say we want.
Yeah.
People who are going to go down and just do what they think is right. You can agree whether you think he's right or not. But I can tell you he does not care.
Yeah. Interesting. David Ferris, do you have a point of view on that?
No, I mean, I think that I do think it raises his profile in a variety of ways. And his ultimate goal may not be to become the Speaker of the House. He may have other ambitions. And, you know, both of the senators in Massachusetts are on the older side. One of them may be running for president. And so I think that for him, you know, raising his name ID alone could be really beneficial for him in the long run, even if he's not able to successfully depose Pelosi.
Right. So, David, I want to turn to sort of your thesis in your book. You've written that it's time for Democrats to fight dirty. And as you write, taking a page out of the Republican playbook, as of last week, it didn't sound like Pelosi had plans to do that. So here she is speaking the day after the election.
I understand that Pelosi can try to frame it in some sexist terms or whatever, but if you look at the broad coalition that's behind her, including the broad coalition.
Sorry, that we've got the wrong cut lined up there. I'll just tell you what Nancy Pelosi said. You know, she said, quote, "We'd like to work together so our legislation will be bipartisan. We're not going for the lowest common denominator. We're going for the boldest kind of denominator. Our position will be a consensus within our own party about what we can support, but also welcoming other ideas." David Farris, does that sound like sort of the approach that you're advocating for?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to note that, you know, Speaker Pelosi is not going to go out there and say, you know, we're going to shut it all down and I'm not willing to work with the president. There's certain things, you know, there's a boilerplate line that you have to say after an election like this,
right,
which is that you're willing to work with the opposition and willing to work with the president. And I think that there are, of course, certain issues where I do think Democrats should play ball if they can score a significant enough moral or political victory. You know, something like helping the Dreamers or reducing the cost of prescription drugs or, prison reform. You know, these things they're worth working with the president on. I think the broader point I make in the book is that you want to toe a very hard line if you're going to cooperate. You want to extract as many concessions as you can. And generally speaking, you don't want to make the president look good, you know, because when an opposition legislature works with an executive. You see this in Massachusetts right now. The executive looks good. The president looks good when Congress is working as it was designed. And I think that this president in particular and the Republicans at this point in time are so dangerous that I think that Democrats should, as much as possible, limit their cooperation to issues where they're getting a really clear win that they might not be able to get at any other time.
Yeah, I mean, at one point in the book, I mean, you write, the Democrats need to obstruct, delay, deny. I mean, put everything on the table for the next 2 years. Is there a downside, though? I mean, can that backfire? I mean, and I'm tell you what I'm thinking of. You know, I'm thinking of when Bill Clinton was all by himself against a Republican-controlled Congress and the Republicans shut the government down going up against Clinton. Clinton was able to sort of use that against them. I mean, doesn't this obstructionist – I mean, if you're too obstructionist, can't it backfire, I guess?
I mean, I could certainly see scenarios where that's true, but I think the broader lesson of the Clinton years is not really about the shutdown. It's about that point when President Clinton and the Republican Congress started working together. That was, you know, after the shutdown. And once, you know, once D.C. started looking like it was functional again and the economy was growing, President Clinton won re-election overwhelmingly. And so I think the depressing lesson of the last, you know, 10 or 12 years of our history is that obstruction does pay and that the voters don't necessarily punish you for it. I mean, I was sure during the Obama era that eventually Republicans would pay a price for refusing to cooperate, even to achieve like really longstanding Republican policy goals like raising the Social Security age. And they just the voters just didn't see it that way. You know, they blamed Obama. The Democrats suffered. And so I think that there's much more upside to a general stance of obstruction than there is to you know, just holding your arms open and say, like, let's work together and bending on a lot of core Democratic principles. I think that will have really negative effects with the base. And I think that they have to hold firm. I'm not saying make no concessions under any circumstances, but I think the general posture needs to be combative.
What do you think, Scott?
Well, I took a broader lesson, I think, from David's book, which I thought was a point exactly well taken. If you look at the results last Tuesday, I think there were 13 million more votes cast for Democratic candidates for Senate, yet we lost two seats nationally. And I think in the House, which is more equally, obviously more egalitarian, in terms of distribution, there were 3 million additional Democratic votes, but we picked up how many seats. So when he's making the point, which I think is well taken, is the Republicans have been really, really good about manipulating the semi-ancient mechanical rules of elections in this country. And so for Democrats to play
hardball— By gerrymandering districts, for example.
Voter suppression, a whole host of things. And yet, in terms of the policy stuff, and I completely agree with this point that we should work on the broad policy issues, is that voters are actually with us. Even if we can't figure out why they're with us, you know, they know what they want the Democratic Party to be and stand for, and we just have to meet them on the ground. And if we can do some of the reforms that David talks about, I think that's a trend I like as a Democrat.
Well, I want to talk specifically about some of those reforms, but I want to get some callers into this conversation. Listeners, we're talking to David Farris. He's a political scientist, author of It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics, and Scott Fersen, Democratic strategist here in Boston. And we're asking you, is it time for Democrats to fight dirty? What do you think? Or is it time, given what happened last week, given the fact that the Republicans still control the Senate, the White House, is it time to look for ways, new ways to work across the aisle? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Steve from Sharon, Massachusetts. And Steve, you want to first talk about Seth Moulton, right?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. And yes, I agree with them. The American people have been voting for drastic change. That's why Bernie Sanders got so many votes, and he probably would have won if Democrats nominated him. And that's why we have Donald Trump. We want drastic change from the establishment. And people like Nancy Pelosi and all the other elderly people running around Congress there represent the same old of getting nothing done.
All right. I hear you, Steve, and I really appreciate the call. David Farris, you know, when I hear Steve, I know that's a sentiment out there, but wasn't one of the lessons of the midterm elections was that a lot of those Democrats who did pretty well, who won and even flipped those red seats, weren't calling for drastic change. I mean, they were certainly in opposition to Trump, but it was a more moderate kind of Democrat that won.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the challenges for Democrats moving forward is that the sort of the activist base of the party really wants to push policy in a certain direction. And I think a lot of the people that won in these suburban districts might be pretty wary of pursuing some of those policies. So I think that that's an unresolved tension within the party. I think it's probably the most important sort of policy fight that Democrats are going to have. And I also think it's important to note that, you know, when voters say they want drastic change, they don't always stick with that. You know, I think like there's a very strong status quo bias in American politics. And so, you know, when politicians come into office saying, you know, promising the voters they're going to do something and then they do it, the voters have seemed to turn against them again and again, at least in the last 20 years. I think you see that with the Affordable Care Act when it was passed and then again when it was when Republicans promised to repeal it. As people didn't really want to see that change at the end of the day, it was sort of scary to them, I guess. So I think moving forward, the Democrats are going to have to be very careful to make sure that the policies that they craft are going to be able to withstand the political challenges that they'll face in the next election after they do these things.
Let's take a call from Ilhan from Somerville. Ilhan, you're on the air. Good to have you. Thanks for the call.
Hi.
Hi there.
Good afternoon.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. So I think that the Democrats should be willing to work with the Republicans as long as the Republicans are willing to work with the Democrats. I think they should probably try to come up with three or four issues that can help them in 2020. I would say Medicare, expanding Medicare, maybe a Green New Deal, again, foreign policy and maybe bringing up more human rights issues and ideally improving and equalizing funding for public education from the federal level.
All right.
But I think, again, they should come up with three or four issues. If they can get a handful of Republicans to support them and work with them, I think that's, you know, they should go ahead with that.
So, David, I want to come back. Thank you, Ilhan, for that call, because this plays, this moves right into something that I wanted to bring up. And David, that is, you in your book, you lay out a series of things the Democrats should do if they regain power in Congress in 2020. And you talk about things like statehood for D.C. and Puerto Rico, court packing, ending winner-take-all elections, modernizing the Voting Rights Act, things like automatic voter registration, making Election Day a national holiday, voting rights for past felons, all these things. So can you respond to the caller and sort of talk about the things that Democrats should take on as a way to ensure they're fighting for the right things?
Sure. I mean, so I think Democrats need to proceed on two paths here. You know, one path is a policy path where they pass a series of sort of Democratic priorities out of the House so that they have that legislation ready to go the next time if they have unified control in Washington after 2020. And on the other path is a set of institutional reforms. Hmm. You know, so these are reforms designed to make it easier for Democrats to play on a level playing field. You know, as Scott was mentioning, a lot of the antiquated procedures and institutions that we have are structurally biased against the Democratic Party right now. You know, so the Senate is probably the single most important structural obstacle to Democratic power right now. So since it's not even this election, if you go back to 1992, Democrats have now won about 40 million more votes for the U.S. Senate since 1992. But at the end of the day, they will only control that chamber for 11 of those 18 years. So
it's an astounding. Astounding set of numbers. Those that you just laid out.
Yeah, and it's the same for the presidency. You know, yeah. I mean, since 92, we've won about 35 million more votes for the presidency, and yet we will not have controlled it for a majority of that time. So I think it's important for Democrats to use the power that they have, the constitutional power that they have, the next time they're in power, to do things like add states, add Democratic-leaning states, not just because it'll help us. I mean, it's also the right thing to do for the people of D.C. and Puerto Rico. You know, modernizing our voting laws is the right thing to do. Encouraging as many people to vote as we can is the right thing to do. And I'm really happy to see Democrats and Nancy Pelosi in particular talking about voting rights as one of the first Democratic priorities when they assume control of the House. And so I think Ilhan is right. You know, they need to focus on policy. They need to determine, you know, three or four policy priorities that they want to make a statement about. I just don't think that they should assume that those things will become law until we get some more power in Washington.
Right. Scott, what's your take on those proposals by David?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think both of the callers, too, pointed out something very fundamental about the way voters are thinking right now is that, you know, I think it's the policies, the progressive policies are largely trending this way. I mean, the arc of the moral universe is long, but trends towards justice. But what's interesting, I mean, think about it. You wouldn't pick a dry cleaner if every week you went to pick up your clothes and they weren't ready, week after week after week. So I think the message here, because there were large numbers of Republicans' seats that were up and in contention in the House and in the Senate, exactly the opposite, that the message was they want change. And change, I think, is less sort of about the policy and more about progress. And they want an agenda that they can identify and that they can see demonstrable accomplishments with. Mm-hmm. And I frankly think that's a positive for Democrats going into the 2020 cycle.
Interesting. Let's go to Greg, who's calling from Sandwich. Greg, you're on the air. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for taking. My point is that, and it's largely falling with the last call, and I think one of the largest stains in recent political history is the night Mitch McConnell stood up and said, we're going to oppose everything and anything that Barack Obama tries to advance. And I think it's led to nothing but stalemate and stagnation in our governments. And I would like to, if the Democrats could put an end to that, turn it around, and let's show the country and the world that this is how we're supposed to be. We're supposed to govern. We're supposed to work together. And we're supposed to accomplish.
I'm into that, Greg. It's a great point. I'm glad you put it on the table. David Ferris, what do you say? What do you say to Greg? And you know, I guess one of the first things I'd say is Mitch McConnell said that, but the Republicans held on to power and are still holding on to quite a bit of power, in spite of saying that about Obama.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can imagine a sort of an alternate political history of the last 2 years, where President Trump actually followed through on some of the compromise priorities that he advanced during the campaign, like protecting or even expanding access to healthcare or really doing a real national infrastructure bill. I think he could have put Democrats in a very difficult place where the party was being offered progress on some significant priorities that their voters care about. It would have made the president look good. And so at the end of the day, the Democrats just have not really been faced with the choice of working with the president. You know, I think the few points where Democrats have been willing to compromise, like funding for the border wall, the ridiculous border wall, in exchange for, you know, cuts in legal immigration, you know, the president just was not willing to bend there to get to yes. And so I don't see any evidence that the president has changed and will offer Democrats, you know, sort of deals that they can't refuse. If he does do that, And it's something that the voters want, that's good for the country. Of course, I think Democrats should be willing to bend. But I don't think that they should start off the negotiating, you know, like I don't think they should look desperate to work with Republicans. Right. Mm-hmm. I think that they need to see the president and they need to see Mitch McConnell sort of strike a different tone. You know, the president did talk about changing his tone before the election. And if he does that, I think that he could score some political points. I think he could put Democrats in a difficult position. But I'm just not sure that I see where that's going to happen. And I'd rather see Democrats get out front, push their policies, push their priorities, and dare the Republicans to meet them halfway.
Interesting. What do you think, Scott?
Well, I think we do run the risk. First of all, I'm skeptical that Nancy Pelosi, should she be Speaker, or anybody else on the Democratic side, or whoever's going to be Speaker, is going to be wanting to accomplish a ton of things. I think everyone is very, very focused on 2020 and the big prize here. But I think to the last caller, I think we'll all be punished if we don't accomplish some things down in Washington. Do we run the risk, if Democrats work with the president, that he will be given credit for those things? Absolutely. But I can tell you there's 100% chance that if anything is accomplished, he will absolutely take credit for it, regardless of how much he had to do with it. So I think, though, that's the way forward. And then we might even get to 2020. This might be a little rose-colored glasses of me, that we could actually have a policy discussion on where the two parties stand, which might be healthy.
That might be really healthy. We only have about a minute left. I want to ask you both just to sort of as a final question, David and Scott. And David, I'll start with you. Just what the big takeaway was from this last election. David, I think you used a term, forgive me if I'm getting it wrong, but that Americans sort of tend toward the middle eventually. I don't know if you put it exactly like that, but was that one of the lessons? Was this sort of a check beginning to pull the pendulum back from one side toward the middle?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know that all Americans are in the middle. I do think that most Americans are a bit afraid of significant radical, like, immediate change, you know. Yeah. And I think that the midterms were a response to two things. You know, they were a response to the unpopularity of the Republican policy agenda. I think first and foremost, these results are the outcome of Republicans trying and failing again and again to repeal the Affordable Care Act and to deprive people of certain protections in the healthcare system. I think that played really badly with voters. I think that in a lot of ways the results last Tuesday were sort of baked in from about a year and a half ago from the July vote on the Senate floor. And I think it's also a reaction against the president's demeanor. You know, I think that a lot of suburban voters in particular, who I think in some ways might be closer to some Republican positions on policy, were so appalled by the way that the president is conducting himself in office that they were driven into the arms of Democrats. And I think Democrats have a real opportunity to keep those voters, maybe transform the electorate, maybe sort of have a Democratic advantage in the House. So
interesting. Scott Ferson, last thought from you on sort of the big lesson from last week.
I think we stumbled into a successful strategy, if you will. If
you look That's at, giving your party all kinds of credit.
Exactly. But I think if you look at the Oklahoma, I think it's the 5th district, where a Democrat for the first time in the longest time, years, 30 years, I think, was elected to Congress. And you look at the Ocasio-Cortez district in Brooklyn, two incredibly different candidates, but both exactly fit their districts. We should take that into 2020.
All right. Scott Ferson is a Democratic strategist and president of the Liberty Square Group in Boston. Scott, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Always great to have you. And joining us from Chicago, David Farris. He's program director for political science at Roosevelt University. His book is It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. David, thank you so much.
Hey, I had a great time. Thanks for having me.
And listeners, thank you for your calls. This conversation continues at RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, the newly expanded More Than Words Warehouse Bookstore in Boston's South End is using the power of books to help young people. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Do you know where your snow shovel is? Oh my God, I can't believe it. It's beginning to feel like winter out there. It's below freezing. It's going to snow later today. Let's check in with WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein, who joins us. Dave, when can we expect this snow to move in? And I wish you'd tell me that it's not true, but it is true.
Yeah, it is true. It's going to move in after the evening commute. That's the good news if anyone's following traffic down in New York City. Always bad for the commute down there, but horrible timing. Snowfall rates at 1 to 2 inches an hour down there, and it's all moving into Connecticut, and it will be here between 7 and 9 p.m. So if you have plans to go out this evening and you don't want to drive in snow, I suggest that you postpone them.
Right. And when is it going to clear up or at least turn into rain? Or maybe the question is, what kind of commute tomorrow morning?
Yeah, so the snow lasts only until about 1 o'clock in the morning at the latest, and then we get the rain. And then overnight tonight, that rain sort of tapers off and shuts down by 9 or 10 in the morning. So tomorrow morning, there's going to be a lot of slush around. Temperatures will be above freezing. I suspect the crews will have done a pretty good job by then. I noticed some of the towns around Metro West have already pre-treated, so they're putting down the chemicals on the roads in anticipation of the snowfall.
All right. Now, David, it feels colder than usual, or is this within the realm of typical for this time of year?
No, we're at the upper end of cold or the lower end of cold, depending on how you want to look at it.
I know what you mean.
If there was a bell curve on cold days, you know, we're at the cold end of that bell curve. So this is chilly. But, you know, up until yesterday, November was averaging 2 degrees above average for the month.
Huh.
So sort of a little bit surprising. I think we're going to erase much of that over the next 2 weeks, and we'll probably end up at or below average for the entire month. But you know, temperatures this time of year on average would be in the mid to upper 40s to lower 50s. So today we're in the 30s. That's more typical for what we'd see around Christmas and New Year's, not just before Thanksgiving.
All right. That's WBUR meteorologist David Epstein joining us via Skype. David, thanks so much. We really appreciate it. Stay warm.
You're welcome.
All right, we all know about the power of books. They help us learn, grow, and escape into worlds beyond our own. The newly expanded More Than Words Warehouse Bookstore in Boston's South End understands that, and it's using the power of books to help young people. Radio Boston producer Paris Alston visited the store and brought us back this story.
More Than Words is a nonprofit that sells used books, but its bigger mission is to help young people who are homeless, in foster care, or involved in the court system. People like Raymond Murray, who says he found out about More Than Words from his group home.
At first, I was kind of skeptical about it, so I didn't really know what it was. Eventually, I decided to come to More Than Words, and I was rather surprised. It was my dream job because, like, all the books here, I love books.
There are tens of thousands of books here. They fill tall wooden shelves. They're used, but most of them look brand new. Big glass windows open the storefront to the street. An antique piano sits nearby, a few crates of vinyl records surrounding it. Murray is among nearly 70 young people who help run More Than Words.
All these books in one place, it's just like a wonderland. Like, it's like I could choose any book to read here if I wasn't working here. I could probably come into work and just start picking out a book, reading it, put it back on a shelf.
Pay starts at minimum wage and goes up as the workers get promoted. But it isn't just about a paycheck. This is also about personal development. On the second floor, More Than Words offers guidance about how to do a job interview, complete a driver's license application, or pursue an academic degree.
I knew that when I first started here, I didn't have no confidence in nothing. My self-esteem was very low.
For many of the young people working here, it's about becoming a better version of themselves. This is Shania King, who says working at More Than Words has helped boost her self-esteem.
I was hard on myself, but just hearing that I am a leader and stuff like that, just like not being hard on myself or just knowing your work is noticed, like you are noticed, like don't take that for granted and don't think that, you know, people are not watching you like grow and stuff like that.
Everybody who comes here is here because they want something different.
Jarrell Mays is the business training manager at More Than Words.
At the same time, we are understanding that they are probably very cautious and guarded about how different it may actually be. They may not have any faith or confidence in the model, but that's really just a lack of faith and confidence in themselves, which we, of course, trying to, you know, enhance through the program.
Customers appreciate More Than Words as well. Andy Robinson, who is perusing the shelves, says the store is a nice addition to the South End.
It's great to see a not super bougie place in the South End, just like a used bookstore kind of joint. I don't think there's a lot of that in the South End. Luxury apartment buildings, there's lots of like spinning classes and stuff, so it's nice to see more of a chill place in the neighborhood.
The founder and CEO of More Than Words is Jody Rosenbaum. She says the focus on books is an essential way the organization helps the young people who work here.
There's something really powerful about our young people seeing that they belong working with books. They are smart. They are capable. They can differentiate between whether a book goes in sociology or, you know, politics. They can decide if something's fiction or nonfiction. They can help people find books. And I think there's something really therapeutic about books.
More Than Words helped more than 200 young people last year. Jody Rosenbaum says they're on track to work with 400 people this year.
Radio Boston's Paris Alston bringing us that story about More Than Words in Boston's South End. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, with help from Eve Zukoff and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Thanks to Renee Marchando today, who engineered our program today. Our executive producer is Hitesh Pathi. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.